Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is its fourth series. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We welcome your feedback. This is the second Countersign podcast explicitly on animals. Earlier this year, I discussed the work of the 19th century philosopher and feminist Frances Power Cobb with the philosopher Alison Stone. In this episode, I'm discussing two immensely important books. The first, The War Against Animals, published in 2015, and the second, Animals and Capital, both authored by Dinesh Wadiwal. Wadiwal is Associate Professor of Human Rights and Sociolegal Studies at the University of Sydney. He has a background in social and political theory and is an expert in human-animal studies and disability rights. It is generally acknowledged that the level of greenhouse gas emissions attributable to the rearing of animals for human consumption is something in the vicinity of 14% to 18% of total greenhouse gas emissions. In this context, I think it makes sense for there to be dramatic reductions in the consumption of animals as food, especially in countries where there is a high per capita rate of food animal consumption. Wadiwal takes a distinct approach to the mass slaughter and industrialized killing of animals. Rather than adopt a normative approach from the outset, which usually amongst liberal theorists involves the identification of particular animals as intrinsically worth more than others, Wadiwal's focus is on violence. Industrial animal agriculture is then treated as a site of violence that is built upon a phantasmatic conception that humans have of themselves as sovereign masters of animals. Just as with Captain Ahab in Herman Melville's novel Moby Dick, humans have got themselves into a monomaniacal position of a frenzied attack on animals and nature, and this has brought both humans and what is classified as nature to the brink of destruction. In his most recent book, Animals and Capital, published in 2023, Wadiwal examines the structural position of animals both as raw materials and also a commodity that is consumed in the process of humans reproducing themselves. In an extremely novel move, he's amongst the first to analyze animal labor as labor. And in this sense, he extends Marx's labor theory of value. In an important theoretical move, Wadiwal distinguishes his theorization from that of new materialists, focusing on relations of power and the politics that arise from antagonistic relationships. Drawing on Afro-pessimist scholars such as Frank Wilderson, especially Wilderson's essay Gramsci's Black Marx, Wadiwal examines the structural antagonism and the place in this structure occupied by animals. Wadiwal's books are amongst the most interesting works on animal studies that I have encountered in recent times. His work also leaves me with important questions, such as what is the relationship between a political analysis of relations of power and the normative claims that humans must go on to make if we are to intervene in the catastrophic destruction of ecosystems and biodiversity. Thank you. Dinesh Wadiwal, welcome to Countersign. I was really excited to read your two books, The War Against Animals, published in 2015, and Animals and Capital, published in 2023. Both books confront an urgent concern in relation to animals as food, although each book takes a different methodological approach to this problem. One way to think about the human reliance on non-human animals as food is to consider it in the context of climate destruction, that altering our relationship to animals is essential in order to secure our own planetary conditions and our own well-being. But of course, that's an extremely anthropocentric approach to this. What has been your sort of broad motivation to do work in relation to the killing of animals for food?
Thank you for having me on the show. And it's really lovely to engage with both of these books in this way. My motivation, I think, was driven by my training as a political theorist and a political theorist who looked particularly at the evolution of violence. So during my PhD, I spent a lot of time particularly focused on, I'd say, European political theory, folks like Foucault and Agamben, but others like Mbembe and others that turn up in my work. And as part of that, I was particularly interested in how did violence evolve as a structural condition of societies, and particularly its link to sovereignty. I spent a long time looking at torture and its evolution in the 20th century. And I think this forms some of the background to my work looking at animals. I'd read a lot of, I would say, normative animal rights theory, which has come from the liberal analytic tradition. And lots of that theory had dealt with our treatment of animals in strictly moral terms. But what I felt was missing was more of a structural account of how we arrived at this place of what I would describe as mass-scale violence against animals. And when I surveyed the terrain and the literature, I couldn't see anything quite like it that tried to do this sort of more structural political theory take on the problem. So that was the sort of impulse behind some of that early work on that you find in that book, The War Against Animals.
Absolutely. And you begin The War Against Animals with this extraordinarily evocative, horrific scene of the live hang, the way in which chickens are slaughtered. And this focus on violence and torture, as you've just emphasized, is, I think, one of the particularly unique approaches that you take in the book, The War Against Animals. And as you say, you distinguish this from the liberal moral approaches that might be thinking about the intrinsic nature or the intrinsic value of animals. Do you want to say a little bit about the context of writing about those scenes of violence?
Sure. Yeah, so the one that you named, the live hang, it describes the routine process that is used in industrial chicken slaughter in the moments before chickens are taken to their death. So typically in industrial slaughter, chickens are picked up by human workers, put upside down into these, I would call them grasping mechanisms, and then put, which are on a conveyor belt, and then swept to their deaths. Usually they go through a stunning tank and then their necks are cut. So that's how they get killed or they're electrocuted. What I noted when I started reading some of these ways that animals were slaughtered or treated within industrial facilities, I couldn't help but notice the resonances with the development of torture techniques against humans. So in the case of some of the studies of the evolution of torture in the 20th century will highlight that one of the areas of development was to use particular position forms of positional torture that literally use the body of the being against themselves. So in the case of positional torture, you make somebody hold their hands up for a long period of time, or you make them squat for long periods of time, or you hang them up in particular positions, and literally the pain and suffering imposed by the endurance of it, that experience, is what constitutes the act of torture. And I think what struck me about some of these practices, like the live hang, is that the body of the animal is used against them in this case. So the body becomes the site of confinement. And to me, this is one example of a point of resonance between human torture as it's practiced against humans and the development of techniques that are used in animal agriculture.
Okay. Now, we'll come to more details about issues of sovereignty and so on that you've also mentioned in relation to the first book, The War Against Animals. But I also wanted to, in this sort of introductory moment, point to the stakes of the discussion in your book. So one of the overarching questions is, should humans stop eating animals? You know, one way to end the torture, to end the violence, to end the ecological destruction that follows from mass animal agriculture is for humans to stop eating animals. But then the broader questions that arise are, would this be all humans? Is there scope for survival-based hunting? What about indigenous and cultural reasons why animals are hunted or otherwise killed? And in my own inhabiting of institutions, I try to push universities and academic gatherings to adopt plant-based or vegetarian food. And there's also the argument that the consumption of animals should be treated like a ban on smoking. In other words, it could be treated as a public health issue. But the problem with that, of course, is that these are all anthropocentric arguments. It's about it's about improving the conditions of human flourishing, although there are consequential outcomes for animals as well. Now, you take a different approach to this. So firstly, just to get a quick take on should humans stop eating animals, I guess, from you, and how you approach this differently to the kinds of arguments that I've just outlined.
No, that's a great provocation and set of questions. I'm not an ethical philosopher, so there are philosophers out there who will analyze the ethical arguments behind, say, meat eating and pronounce on these issues. It's not something that's part of my work. In fact, in none of my work do I ever tell people what they should eat. My interest comes as a political philosopher, and it's an interest in systems of violence and domination with a general, I guess, justice focus, which says that if we can eliminate violence, if we can deal with domination, that this is generally a good or a just thing to do. So I think that's the focus of what I do, but it leads to a different set of questions. So where the moral philosopher might ask, is it wrong to eat animals? Or is it wrong to, if there's alternatives, should we change our diet? I'm much more interested in a different question, which is, if violence against animals is wrong, and if it is preventable, then shouldn't we seek to do that? Mm-hmm. Alternatively, what are the institutions, or how do institutions collaborate to produce this mass scale violence? And what tools do we have to reduce this or eliminate it? As part of my work, I was particularly focused on industrial animal agriculture, because demonstrably, if we look at the history of the 20th century and beyond, demonstrably, it is about industrialization and the application of, I'll call them capitalist processes of production to animal agriculture that have led to a huge explosion in the use of animals for food, and to me also lead to the factory farm as a creation. So to me, that's the main target of a lot of my work, is industrialization and intensification. Though again, this raises some different questions about, well, for people who, for example, hunt food for subsistence purposes, is this a moral issue? Well, it's not really within the scope of the work I do. Mm-hmm. Though again, it's not unreasonable for those individuals or collectives of individuals to consider the place of animals within food systems as an ethical or even a political issue for those communities. But it's not something that I directly engage with. And of course, if you ask me, I'd say, look, for most of the world, there's today the structural capacity to make changes around food. And that could be at the level of consumption. So as you describe, lots of institutions cement in forms of animal product consumption that could easily be changed at really mm-hmm. no cost to anybody. Mm-hmm. And both in terms of the other impacts like environment and other reasons, but in terms of the impacts on animals, there's every reason to do those, to make those changes. But at the same time, I'd recognize that there are communities around the world who have strong cultural and economic dependence on the use of animals for food, and change in those contexts is going to be more complex. So I don't make moral pronouncements about what people eat, mm-hmm. but I am interested in the structural conditions that produce domination and violence.
Okay, so that's really clear that your focus is on violence, on systems of violence. But then what follows from that is treating violence against animals as a problem. Now, usually it's because of the moral status or the political status of a being that violence becomes a problem. So how do you address that in relation to animals?
So yes, they are interconnected. So I don't mean at all to say that questions of ethics are completely disconnected. Though again, I'd also want to question analytic philosophers who'll say, we just have this conceptual problem with the way that we've understood animals, that conceptual in the sense that we've misunderstood that certain animals have intelligence and sentience, and therefore if we recognize this, we should change our legal systems. Because of my training, of course, the reality is that we look at at how violence and domination happens, actually our systems of knowledge collaborate with systems of violence to produce a subject who is violated. So we know this when we look at, say, gender-based violence or racialized violence or how colonialism work, that actually systems of knowledge or epistemology worked in concert with systems of physical violence and constraint to produce a reality of violence. And it's not just a misunderstanding, if you like, it's the collaboration of those two things. So I would probably quibble with some strictly analytic philosophers who'll say this is just all in the space of morality, and that once we recognize that great apes or whoever have personhood rights, we solve the problem. It's actually, to me, actually misses the point that our societies are structured in such a way that the reproduction of violence is essential to the structure of those societies. And this collaborates with the knowledge order as well. So all of that goes together, and we need to unpack all of those things if we want to deal with that problem of violence.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And you're pointing to the complexities. So for instance, when I adopt an anti-carnivorous politics in, as I said, in various institutional settings and so on, I have received a response that I'm being anti-Muslim, for example. And this is a recognition that there is ethno-national and caste-based and religious-based discrimination and violence and chauvinism based on an anti-carnivorous stance. So that's important to recognize. And veganism and vegetarianism can also be deployed in civilizational and racialized ways. So have you confronted those sorts of issues in your thinking, and how do you respond to that?
Absolutely. So, and I think you're absolutely right. I think this anecdote you gave about the times you've experienced pushing a kind of plant-based diet and then being called anti-Muslim, they illustrate a number of complex problems, and some of them actually are frustrating. So firstly, let's note that in making this statement, people who say, well, that's anti-Muslim, you're erasing the reality and histories of Muslims who have actually practiced vegetarianism, mm-hmm. right? Which is, yes. There's a history around that. And yep. There's also a continuing discourse. You're also, those critics are also simultaneously engaging in a kind of Islamophobia where they're pretending that Muslims cannot be part of a conversation about their mm-hmm. food systems and the relationship to culture, right? So that it's overlaid, and I know you know all this stuff, but it's overlaid with some truly bizarre like assumptions. But I just want to also just put another approach, and this is central to the way that I take on some of these issues, and another way of looking at it, which is that if we look at the history of animal-based food consumption, up until the 20th century, most people didn't eat very much meat anywhere, right? That was the reality of global diets, right? That most people, and again, like this is, it would different, there'll be differences in different countries, different, you know, communities, and differences within communities as well, which, you know, typically reflected proximity to animal agriculture, but also wealth and prestige. But most people on the planet just didn't eat that much meat, right? 20th century comes along, food production intensifies, animal-based foods globalize and become a kind of hegemonic force. And most of the world's diets change. And I'm not just saying this. We can just look at the data we have. Mm-hmm. We look at the UN Food mm-hmm. and Agriculture Organization data. What it tells us is not only rising per capita meat consumption, but that everybody's diet changes around the world. And what I find curious about these sorts of statements people make, oh, well, you're being anti-Muslim or you're being anti-Catholic or whatever it is that they miss that actually the true force that has actually changed the consumption patterns of most of the world isn't about vegans saying maybe you should change your diet. It's actually capitalism and anthropocentrism, which have fundamentally changed the cultures of most people across the planet. But what I find curious is that people don't look at that, point to that and say, well, that's anti-Muslim, right? Or that is anti-Christian, or that's anti-Buddhist or anti-Hindu, which genuinely it is. I'd say that capitalism is genuinely anti all of those things if we consider what it's done to everyday life and the kind of diets that people eat. So to me, actually, that gives us a different way to even look at this whole problem, right? And I've encountered similar stuff where people have said, with in relation to my work, are you telling me what to eat, or my culture what to eat? And of course, I can say, well, there's nothing in my work that ever tells anybody what to eat. But I can also point to the fact that actually we are witness to a range of historical processes that have fundamentally changed cultures and have done so without reciprocation and without permission. And nobody seems to want to call that out, right, as a problem or as examples of a kind of anti-culture, like a kind of racism, right, in the way that it's operated.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how culture gets deployed in these discussions, you know, culture as a sort of defense, culture as an essentialism. And as you were saying, you know, why isn't it possible to have a conversation about food systems with any community or any form of affiliation or orientation? Now, delving more deeply into your two books, in The War Against Animals, you draw on various critical theories around sovereignty. And sovereignty is an important sort of analytic or a concept that you work through the different chapters. And interestingly, in the context of a war against animals or characterizing violence against animals as a sort of sovereign war, you end with a call for a truce. And that is generally how a war ends. And I found it incredibly evocative, your deployment of Melville's Moby Dick, the story of Captain Ahab, who's had his leg torn off by the white whale. And then engages in a pursuit, a sort of as the novel puts it, a sort of monomaniacal pursuit, which is self-destructive of Ahab. And in his final moments, Ahab relinquishes his spear, and that's a moment of disarmament, as you put it. And I think your discussion of that book is just incredible. But there's something suicidal about Ahab's pursuit. Pursuit of the whale. So he's got himself to such a position that he destroys himself. And this seems quite a useful allegory for what humans have done with the planet as well. There's a kind of monomaniacal level of consumption and an unquestioning, seemingly unquestioning acceleration of industrial production of animals. So firstly, I wanted you to say a little bit more about your drawing on various theorists of sovereignty, and then to address this question of the sort of suicidal position that humans seem to have got themselves to.
Sure. Yeah, so the engagement with sovereignty partly was a reflection on where some of the field, and particularly the liberal political theory that was happening in the field, what it was reflecting on. So at the time I wrote The War Against Animals, one of the most prominent books within a sort of what's been described as the political turn of animal studies was a book called Zoopolis by Will Kimlicker and Sue Donaldson. And the book has proved very influential. Will Kimlicker, of course, is a famous liberal multicultural theorist who, with Sue Donaldson, produced this remarkable text on animal rights. And I think it is a really important text in the field. Part of that text, they do theorize sovereignty, and they make an argument which follows some previous liberal political theorists. They make this argument that wild animal communities have a political sovereignty that we should respect. But when I wrote The War Against Animals, I became much more interested in understanding sovereignty as a useful way to describe what I later describe as hierarchical anthropocentrism. It's a kind of anthropocentrism where humans place themselves in a position of authority and superiority through violence and domination over animal life. So that's the way I describe sovereignty. And it partly came from a particular reading of Michel Foucault. So Foucault in the 70s, I'm going to say 75, 76 lectures that are published under the title Society Must Be Defended, puts forward what I think is a remarkable thesis around sovereignty. So he contests the liberal conception of sovereignty and says liberalism imagines a kind of social contract, a kind of general agreement behind sovereignty that founds constitutional power. But in reality, we know that sovereignty is founded upon war, violence, bloodshed, shared slavery. This is the historical reality. So in a sense, Foucault is making an argument that's resonant with other theorists like Charles Mills. But what I think is interesting about Foucault is that he ends up linking it to his theory of biopolitics. So he argues that states basically enshrine within the sovereign order fundamental inequalities between those who are victorious in war and those who lose wars, and that these form the basis of the state racism that states pursue after this. But when I read this thesis, firstly, of course, I agreed with it. I think this is a reasonable analysis of the history of sovereignty. But secondly, when I read this thesis, all I could think about were animals. In my view, this perfectly described our relation with animals. It's not that we humans are somehow born superior to animals. It's actually we've imagined ourselves in this way and then granted ourselves almost unlimited rights to exert violence upon animals in order for those animals to meet our needs. So to me, this seemed a very persuasive way to describe our relations. And also it became a persuasive way to describe sovereignty as essentially about human sovereignty, the processes by which we humans have decided to delegate ourselves or create ourselves as sovereign masters and to justify through violence that continuing reign of domination that we have over animals. So that's where I start to frame the book. And the war against animals, the framing is basically to say, look, if we look out at our relations with animals, in most cases, the vast majority of our direct relations with animals involve violence and domination. And this is not only in our food systems and experimental labs, but also in seemingly benign places like companion animal regimes, where in a sense we like to imagine that these are friendly spaces, but companion animals are typically incarcerated within our homes. They're subject to forced bodily modifications such as sterilization. We control food, we control sociality, we control sexuality, and all of these things are actually regimes of domination to meet human interests. So taking that all into account, I say, well, what's a way to describe this? And I take the framing of war and basically make the argument that maybe as a political theorist it makes sense to describe this as a state of ongoing conflict and violence, seeking to achieve domination, and war is a reasonable way to describe this. I guess this leads to that discussion about truce, which you mentioned. And I think to me, of course, we can't move forward to establish peaceable relations unless there is a truce, and maybe that's something we can talk about. But that final scene with Catherine Ahab and the suicide or the death wish, I think there's, to me, yes, when I wrote that, I was immediately aware of climate change as a very clear example of the kind of collective monomania of humanity, which has driven planetary systems to their limit and is destroying the base of reproduction for human populations as we speak. Animal agriculture is tied into this. So currently, the estimates are something between 14 and 18% of carbon emissions are due to animal agriculture. The curious thing is that in some ways is the easiest thing for us to change. So it's far harder to change energy systems and transport than it is to change what we eat. Yet it is proved, because of the cultural resistance, it's proved hardest to change food systems. And the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has done the most tiptoeing around food systems, right? Because of this, because of the investment in animal agriculture. So to me, this is an example of a kind of death wish. Somewhere in the footnotes of the War Against Animals, I think I talk about I think it was when the World Health Organization came out and said, you know, preserved or smoked meat products are definitely carcinogenic and red meat is probably carcinogenic. And there was a headline, I think it was in The Guardian, from maybe it was an Argentinian expert saying, we'd rather die than give up meat. And to me, this is Moby Dick. Right? This is the Captain Ahab moment, where are we really committed to killing the planet and ourselves for this food that we want? And are we so committed to this ongoing mass scale violence and domination of animals for the food that we want to eat? And to me, it's a good example of that suicidal logic at play.
There's a sort of ambivalence perhaps in relation to sovereignty and the place of sovereignty. So which the place of sovereignty in your thinking? So what kinds of sovereignty is hierarchical and to be disavowed. And there's a sort of strong critique here of sovereignty. And then, and this is sort of signaling some of the conversation we'll have a bit later about indigenous responses to settler colonialism and the importance of sovereignty. And so the way in which sovereignty remains a register that we have to move in and out of, I think, is something that I want to hold on to. But we'll get to that. The other really evocative aspects of the war against animals and animals and capital is the metaphors and comparisons, allegories of violence that you draw on. I was particularly struck in War Against Animals on your citation of Andrea Dworkin's address to a men's group against violence for women in Minnesota in, I think, something like 1983, where Andrea Dworkin, the feminist scholar and activist, addresses this men's group and says, you know, so you want to know what you, I'm just sort of paraphrasing now, you want to know what you can do to address violence against women. Well, I would just like one day, you know, it's not so much to ask, it's so little to ask for one day without violence, one day without rape. So please go out and try to ensure that, you know, I and other women can have one day without this violence. And you later, signal the possibilities of alliances between feminists, indigenous, critical race, Afro-pessimist politics in relation to ending the structural conditions that produce animals as food. Now, there are methodological tensions here between the sort of post-structural literatures you draw on in both books and also on the structural relations of value, which we'll come to, and we'll discuss that in more detail. But I just wanted to get a sense here on any tensions that you, you know, kind of encountered when you deploy statements such as the one by Andrea Dworkin. So, you know, is there a hesitation perhaps to say, okay, what Dworkin is saying about women, you know, is this the same as what happens to animals? You know, is there, because I can also imagine people saying, yes, but there's no, you know, to use the phrase that analytic philosophers might use, you know, there's no moral equivalence here. Or, you know, we're not talking about the same thing. How do you kind of address that issue?
That's a great question. And I think in a way it's a question of method and presentation. Something that I really worked on with that book and my writing since is finding ways to compare and reflect on the resonances between different social movements without firstly collapsing two very different struggles into each other, or drawing clumsy analogies that actually don't do services to those movements. Unfortunately, animal rights theory has a bad history around this. So a commonly cited debate has been the sometimes clumsy analogy made between racial slavery and the treatment of animals. And this has, of course, pissed off protesters or activists against anti-Black violence, and hasn't done any services for the possibility of alliances between animal rights movements and anti-racist and anti-colonial movements. In my work, actually, I really try very carefully to point out that these resonant social movements face actually very similar problems in what I start out by saying are very different arenas. Right? So I don't make the comparison or say that they're the same thing. But I also note that frequently we're dealing with the same rationalities, the same logics, the same technologies, and sometimes the need for the same strategies that animal rights folk can actually learn from. So let me give you, just to give you an example, it's frequently said that animals don't have language and therefore we can't understand what they want. And therefore, we are justified in using paternalistic approaches in their treatment. Now, what strikes me about this is that actually human groups have faced this same logic. So many people with disability globally face this same paternalistic logic, where it's assumed that because a person cannot communicate in a way that is normatively acceptable, that therefore they should be subject to paternalistic treatment. But also, we know from the history of racism and colonialism that it gets deeper than that, that the colonizer can come and impose their knowledge systems on another and treat the fact that the other is framed by those knowledge systems as evidence that they should be subject to violence and exclusion. And this would be broadly what, say, Spivak would call epistemic violence. So to me, actually, reflecting on those histories of different social movements actually provides a lot of material for understanding the statements routinely made by so-called experts around animals, that animals lack the means to communicate to us, so therefore we can subject them to violence and paternalistic treatment. To me, actually, we have lots of evidence that we can use. Now, in making that comparison, I'm not saying that people with disability or colonized people are the same as animals, but I'm noting that actually none of this should be surprising if we understand the history of oppression, violence, domination, and the way that social movements have responded to those situations. Now, saying all that, I want to note that, of course, there are tensions, right? So some of those tensions are actually about not necessarily the comparisons, although, as I said, some of the ways that comparisons have been made have been not helpful, but actually problems around the material reality of alliances, right? So I'd say actually the way that we need to work out tensions is by the hard work of actually building alliances between social movements towards change, right? And that's actually where the hard work needs to happen. We shouldn't start by saying, oh, your struggle is the same as mine, because actually it's not, right? The experiences of, say, feminists trying to combat patriarchal societies and anti-racism activists trying to deal with histories of colonialism aren't necessarily collapsible into each other. And I'm definitely not somebody who believes that there is one big oppression that we're trying to deal with. But that doesn't deny the possibility of alliances and alliance politics to make change. But building alliances is actually hard work. And it involves agreeing potentially on the terrain and the history that has led us to this point, but also potentially, and more importantly, agreeing on where we're going. And that's hard work, right? And so I suppose I would treat those tensions as problems that are resolvable, but actually in the material space of building alliances and not necessarily resolvable in an analytic sense.
Okay, now we're going to shortly take the deep dive into to Marx and theories of value, which I think are really important in animals and capital. But before you get to that point in the book Animals and Capital, I think you very importantly distinguish your thinking and your theorization from new materialism and flat ontologies and the sort of what you characterize as the political monism articulated by Rosie Bray Dotti and Jane Bennett. And you want to return to the dialectics of antagonism. So I thought I just wanted you to explain a little bit the theoretical moves you make there. And just in addition to those thinkers, Bray Dotti and Bennett, you also draw on Kimberly Crenshaw's notion of intersectionality and build on her work. So I thought that these are important sort of stepping off points in the book Animals and Capital. So if you could lay that out for us.
Sure. So new materialism is, of course, a really exciting theoretical direction that we've seen in the last 10 or 15 years. And what I think is exciting about it is that it has started to articulate a return to a materialist politics, but without anthropocentrism. And I think this is, you know, one of the interesting things about that. And it, as a result, has started to challenge nature-culture distinctions. It started to challenge questions around ontology and standpoint, which are really important philosophical discussions. One aspect of some of those discussions has been an emergence of an interest in fundamental ontological categories and an interest particularly in a return to a monism at the level of ontology. And what I mean by that is that if we think about, say, the fundamental, like the ontology of, say, Heidegger, there's Dasein, there's the prototypical human, there's the animal, there's the stone, like that these are treated as fundamentally different categories. Whereas new materialists are interested in, well, in what way are those categories actually not stable? And in what ways does a kind of relational ontology allow us to see that all being is intertwined or entangled with each other in interesting ways that produces the reality that we have before us? Now, none of that I actually object to. I think this is really exciting. fascinating work that's descriptive at the level of philosophical ontology.
Can I just interject there and just say, can you just explain a little bit further what makes that monistic? So I think it's very important, that reference to Heidegger, his sort of essay. I was recently discussing it in another context where Heidegger says, you know, the stone has no conception of world, the animal is poor of world, and man is world making. So how does that, and obviously Braidotti and Bennett are departing from this this ontology and articulating a sort of ontology of entanglement and relation and the agency of actants and so on. So just so listeners are clear how you're using the term monistic here.
I guess, I mean, a simple way, and that's a great question, a simple way to understand it would be a dualistic ontology. One, for example, would be subject and object. The world at the level of fundamental philosophical categories is composed of beings who have self-consciousness in a way that describes a kind of fundamental subjectivity and free self-determination. And then there's a world of objects that subject appropriates. So this would be a dualistic, I would describe as a dualistic ontology. And I think the move that some new materialists are making is to collapse the easy distinction between these things. And certainly, if we think about relationality and the way that beings grapple with each other to produce a reality, to me, there's something credible about this idea that we don't live in a world of just purely subjects and objects, that actually there is something that is more cohesive and is about, you know, and there's some different theories about this, but some people will say that either that the idea that a rock is not an agent doesn't make sense, and that actually not only recent work in actor network theory and other approaches has theorized the agency of rocks, but also different knowledge traditions such as indigenous traditions have always theorized or conceptualized inanimate objects as agents, right? So that some of that is breaking down. I think this is all very productive at the level of philosophy. The question I raise, though, is how does this relate to politics? So in some of the work, and I'd say Jane is an example of this, there's this almost too easy slide between a monistic ontology to what I would say is a political monism, which is a belief that actually the field of politics is similarly just an entangled field where different co-actors produce this reality before us. And to me, this doesn't tally with how I would see politics. I mean, politics is about power, and it is frequently a description of the way that agents in contestation, sometimes antagonistic life and death relations with each other, produce a reality before us. So to me, that's what politics is. It's not, and of course, politics is not the same as ontology. I mean, we can separate the two discussions, and I'd say that we need to, because in my view, ontological categories don't cleanly produce political categories. There's a relation, of course, right, with the idea that maybe the way that we've ontologically conceptualized the world plays into the hierarchical anthropocentrism that has produced this violent reality we have with animals and nature. But I don't see this clean relationship between politics and ontology, and I don't think it does us as any service describing politics in these ways, because it doesn't fairly describe clearly antagonistic relations such as the historical relation and ongoing relation of colonialism. To me, this cannot be described with a form of political monism. So in the book, I just make the claim that actually it's useful to maintain an idea of antagonism and potentially a kind of dialectics that flows from antagonism, though I'm not really a dialectical thinker, though there are elements of dialectics in my work. I want to stress, though, that most of what new materialists argue for, I agree with. I fundamentally agree with. But at this level, about how to deal with politics, I think we need more. There's more work to be done, and I think we're probably rushing. It feels rushed to get rid of these old categories for thinking about politics when they're actually very useful for describing the reality we have before us. You asked about intersectionality.
About Kimberly Crenshaw and intersectionality. Yes.
Yeah. So one thing that in the book, I'm particularly interested in Frank Wilderson, who maybe we can come back to, who's broadly classed as an Afro-pessimist thinker. And Wilderson is particularly interested in antagonism, structural antagonism, as a driving force of history. In Animals and Capital, I kind of read Wilderson and Crenshaw together. And something I note is that intersectionality, at least in Australia where I am, intersectionality has become almost a kind of benign online policy buzzword. Like, you literally read it in policy documents. And there's also some, what I would say, some misreadings as a result of what intersectionality was about, or even what Crenshaw's original project was about. Something that struck me about reading some of the early work of Crenshaw was that Crenshaw is, in some of that work, quite divided about whether women of color, or black women in particular, which are the focus of some of those early essays, can actually be saved by the existing social movements that she sees around. And she's pointing to, in a way, the structural uniqueness of the position of women of color or black women. So she uses the two terms interchangeably. In my view, what I find interesting about the way that intersectionality is read in some of those early essays is that it's not so much a description of someone's identities intersecting, which is some of the poor ways that intersectionality is described, but quite literally, and Crenshaw says that the point of her analysis is to move away from identity politics. It's a description of the structural position of black women or women of color within a terrain of power, and also a description of the limits of existing anti-racial movements, anti-racism movements, and the feminist movement, the white feminist movement, in actually accounting for this position. So to me, this is actually, it connects in a weird way with the recent direction of particularly race scholarship informed by Afro-pessimism, which is much more interested in the structural position of individuals, but also the antagonism of those positions. The fact that, and when I say antagonism, the fact that it is not possible to imagine one social movement achieving liberation without the other social movement experiencing the opposite, right? Because the domination of one group is dependent upon the liberation of another. So in a sense, I think Crenshaw heads partly in that direction. She does suggest that in some of those early essays that probably anti-racist movements have the best prospect of achieving change for black women or women of color. But this will require substantial work within those movements to actually highlight the issues that women of color face, right? So she lays out a roadmap that's quite specific, but also expresses this hesitation about the capacity of existing social movements to actually account for this unique structural position.
I think that's, I think that's a great sort of segue into the next question, which was going to focus on your reliance on Frank Wilderson's distinction between the worker and the slave in this very influential essay, Gramsci's Black Marx, from 2003. And in that essay, there's a passage from Wilderson where he draws a metaphor between the slave and the cow. Just to quote the passage that you rely on in several places in the book, I quote, "Would it feel more like freedom to be slaughtered by a workers' collective where there was no exploitation of the worker, as opposed to being slaughtered in the exploitative context of that dreary old 9-to-5? And so, end of quote. And so that is a critique that he's making of Gramsci's position here in relation to the hegemony that the worker might achieve if they seek better, workers may achieve if they seek better conditions. And the point Wilderson is making is that the structural position of the black person in the in society remains outside the reforms and progress that can be achieved through the achievement of a certain kind of progressive hegemony of a social movement. You know, so Wilderson's point is the black person, like the slave, is always outside. And the metaphor is with the cow and the cow in the slaughterhouse. So do you want to say something more about, you know, how important this analysis is to your argument?
It's really important in the sense that, firstly, Wilderson is trying to express the fact that if whiteness depends upon black subjugation, if whiteness as a structure, as a bundle of privilege and distinction, if it structurally depends upon the continual subordination of blackness, then the imagination that the left movement, whether it's Marxists or liberals, through their own liberation projects would be able to simultaneously save black people is illusory. So this is the argument that he makes in that essay. But he simultaneously deploys this analogy that you describe, where he talks about this slaughterhouse, socialism has come, and he says, well, are the cows being saved? And he kind of says, well, you know, clearly the slaughterhouse isn't overproducing commodities to make surplus. So the workers are working less, there are probably less animals being killed, but animals are still being killed because that form of liberation was not adequate to actually deal with the structural positioning of animals in relation to humans. Now, the reason I found this interesting is, firstly, again, what I find exciting about Wilderson's project is that he wants to keep structural antagonism in place as a way to understand fundamental social categories. And he, through that essay, but also the other texts, the other important texts that I refer to, Red, White, and Black, he highlights that maybe other relations are not antagonistic in this way, but what he believes marks the particular positioning of the black subject is the reliance of the white subject and others for their freedom on the unfreedom of the black subject. Now, to me, this actually is very useful for understanding the relationship of animals to humans. And in a weird way, the war against animals basically describes this problem. But one thing I'd say that is useful about this analogy that Wilderson draws is that, of course, it highlights, although I'm not clear that Wilderson intended this, it highlights the problem for animal advocates with the socialist / Marxist project itself. That arguably, as long as animals appear as both the means of production and the means of subsistence for capitalism, then it might be too much to ask those movements to actually be interested in the liberation of animals. And that, of course, is something I keep in sight in the book, although I express the hope in the book that we can develop a kind of left politics that can take into consideration the experiences of animals and be interested in their liberation. I also express, because of that analogy, I express the continual suspicion that maybe Marxist movements or left movements are not up to this task. So I wish I could give a more optimistic spin in the book, but I'm not sure with this book.
Yeah, so let's, a really important point, and we could actually discuss this in far more length and in the book Animals and Capital. I think there is a very detailed exposition and discussion of Marx's value theory, and you don't do what theorists like Agamben often do, which is to say that they're correcting some previous philosopher. And I do think you're correcting Marx, but you have the humility not to say that you're correcting Marx. And so what I want you to elaborate for us is what you do with Marx's theory of value in relation to the animal as raw material, and then a different kind of commodity in the process of production and sure. reproduction. Yeah.
Yeah. So one point I make is that, so in Marx's, you know, value theory, but labor process theory, he would describe different factors of production or different lives of commodities within production. And he'd say that elements of production appear either as raw materials, as labor, or as finished commodities. In Animals and Capital, I make the argument that we can quite easily understand animals as raw materials because that's the reality we see before us. So typically, global agribusiness deploys billions of animals as raw materials, their lives, and they are confined within agricultural systems and serve a function in becoming eventual consumption commodities for humans. That second positioning, the consumption commodity, I think is also worth reflecting on. But one thing I do in the book is to point out that this isn't just merely that animals become food and that's the end of it, and that human consumers buy this food and that's the end of it. It's actually that capitalism has positioned these beings, their lives, as a means of subsistence, and has fundamentally, as we talked about previously, altered human food supplies to position animals as one of the most fundamental elements of the means of subsistence. Of course, for Marxists, the means of subsistence isn't just what we eat because we like it. It's actually the means for the reproduction of human populations, and with that, human labor. Other scholars, such as Jason Moore, have made the argument that capitalism has worked to manipulate food supplies, to cheapen food as a way to drive down wages, the wage bill of capitalism. But an argument that I make that's resonant and I guess in league with what Moore's argument is that it's not just that animal-based food has been made cheaper, it's actually that animal-based food has become one of the primary pillars of human survival and reproduction. So capitalism has positioned animal-based food as key to the reproduction of the human labor force. But the final way that think about animals, and it's something that is more controversial and less discussed. In fact, I think probably I'm one of the first to just do this systematically, is to describe animals as labor. Traditional Marxists reject the idea that animals labor. And that's because in some ways, one argument would be Marx just, when he wrote Capital, he just described the factors of production as he saw them. Animals were just treated as raw materials, and that's the end of the story. But to me, actually, I think there's something that's missed in this analysis. And that's because, actually, if we look at animal agriculture, there are all sorts of ways that animal agriculture have to deal with animals as a form of labor, as well as a raw material. So to give you one example, so I make the argument that if we treat animals metabolic labor, their labor upon themselves as value producing. This helps to explain certain perversities that happen around animal agriculture. So one example is that it's no surprise that producers have been in a race to the bottom to increase yield as a proportion of the feed that goes into the system. So there's all sorts of scientific research on both what feed to give animals, but also how much yield can be maximized from that level of feed to maximize profit. Now, this to me could be read as, oh, well, they're just, you know, this is just human labor adding to the production process and animals are just raw materials. But actually a more interesting and probably accurate way to read this is that this is actually about animal labor time. It's actually about in exactly the same way that Jason Moore, for example, talks about the manipulation of human food supplies to shape human reproduction, human labor reproduction. In a similar way, animal agriculture producers are doing exactly the same thing with the inputs of grain and pharmaceuticals into animal agriculture, which manipulate the metabolic productions of animals to generate surplus. It also, this description to me is also really useful in that it helps to highlight one of the important drivers of animal agriculture. In a traditional Marxist point of view, the point of animal agriculture is to make labor or reduce, increase the efficiency of labor so that you can extract the most surplus. But Marxists are typically only interested in human labor. In my view, actually, if we treat animal agriculture as a conglomerate of animal and human labor, it gives us a much more sophisticated picture. It firstly gives us a way to account for the systematic reduction of human labor time in animal agriculture and the emergence of robotic, fully automated forms of animal agriculture. But simultaneously tells us about the ways that capitalist agriculture has had to deal with both the massification, the multiplication of animal lives in animal agriculture, but how to make those lives as cheap as possible, how to extract as much profit from them. And it's done this by manipulating feed growth conversion ratios or lengthening or shortening the lives of animals so that you reduce the production cycle and extract profit more quickly. So to me, that these talking about animal labor becomes a really important way to describe some of this reality we see before us. And I guess that would be one way I might be trying to correct Marx. But as you say, I'm not really correcting Marx. I'm just applying him without an anthropocentrism that he himself had.
Well, that's very modest of you. but no, I thought it was, as you say, an incredibly original part of the book. Now, we don't have as much time to go into, I think, fascinating discussion you have of animal resistance. In the process of production, there's a great chapter on fish, for instance, where there is maybe some ambiguity around whether fish feel pain or not. There's certainly research that suggests that they do, but they certainly resist being caught. And so animal resistance plays an important role in your argument. You also, as you alluded to previously, are looking to think about the alliances that may be struck between animal advocates and labor movements, that is to say, currently anthropocentric labor movements of trade unions. So I'd like you to say a little bit more about that.
Sure. Yeah. So the book, I guess, ends with maybe the gamble that it is possible to imagine alliance movements that both represent humans and animals. There's some examples that I use in the book. So, you know, one example would be wild fish capture. Currently, if we look at wild fish capture globally, typically, if we look at particularly Southeast Asia, the bulk of the fishing happens with Chinese and Thai fishing vessels. There have been numerous concerns raised by international labor organizations about low wages and forced labor on those vessels. In my view, this is an issue that is ripe for alliance politics. And that's the reason is that what those fishing vessels do to fish is an absolute nightmare. As I outline in the book, when we're talking about wild fish capture, there is zero in terms of animal welfare protection. And many of those fish that are hunted down by wild capture fishing vessels, will die completely horrible deaths. That's leaving aside the fact that this is also an environmental disaster. And this is why a range of global organizations have labor organizations have worked with environmentalists to point out that, you know, we're fishing the oceans dry, and it's not just a disaster for human labor, it's also a disaster for the environment. Now, to me, this is a really obvious alliance issue, but we haven't seen animal advocates engaging with those organizations in a systematic way. But of course, we haven't seen those organizations particularly interested in the issues for fish. So to me, there's work to be done, but that is at the level of alliances. This doesn't mean that the goals of animal advocates are the same as those of labor rights activists. Of course not, right? But if I look at wild capture fisheries, this is an industry in decline that is waiting for a push. And maybe this is one area where animal advocates can make change. Yeah. So to me, I'm interested in some of those examples. But more broadly, I think, and this relates to climate change, we have before us a quite significant challenge about the future of our food systems. So although nobody wants to talk about it, it's pretty clear that sometime in the next 2 to 3 decades, some pretty stark choices are going to need to be made about the future of our food systems. I would hope that those decisions would be made in a democratic way that reduces income inequality and promotes empowerment for both people and animals. But that's only going to happen through social movement struggle. Again, in my view, animal advocates have to be part of those conversations and part of the social movements that are pushing for a fairer food system, but also producing the visions for what we want that food system to look like.
Yeah. And in terms of alliances, I think you also make really important points about indigenous plant-based movements and indigenous interventions, for example, in Australia in relation to the infamous kangaroo cull that seems to have become institutionalized but has been challenged both within Australia and globally. There's the UN Declaration for Kangaroos in 2021 when indigenous communities and leaders intervened in these discussions, and here showing the relationship between racial and anti-colonial justice with the treatment and violence against animals. But then at a broader level, you also draw attention to the networks of circulation, of transport, of live animal exports and transportation, and the massive capital investments that are placed in these kinds of structures. So that's the kind of space where structural antagonism takes place, and where alliances between workers and animals or animal advocates need to focus. I think of a country like Australia, where you're sitting and where I've also spent a great deal of time. And I think of the sort of cultural investment of, you know, putting a steak on the barbie or having your prawns for Christmas, and the extraordinary shifts that would have to take place culturally for people to see alliances between their own position and that of the animals or the crustaceans or the seafood that is consumed in such vast quantities. I mean, what's your sense of, apart from the catastrophes that, as you signaled, are coming in the next 2 to 3 decades in relation to food systems and food production? What's your sense of the kinds of interventions that could build these alliances? senses and make them more real?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think Australia is a highly contradictory place. It's also perhaps a bit unlike other countries in that most other nations had a relatively low per capita meat consumption at the turn of the 20th century. Australia marks itself out by actually having a very high meat consumption. And that's because it has a relatively small population, largely working in agriculture, and lots of animals that was the main export. And the promise for the settlers, often British settlers, was that come to Australia, migrate to Australia, because you're going to eat meat every day. Right? And you can actually see this statistically. Australians ate more meat than anyone else, pretty much. So Australia has this sort of culture that's embedded with that. But I think something, and this relates to Indigenous self-determination movements, something that strikes me about Australia is the intertwining, and others have written about this, the intertwining of settler colonialism or the settler colonial model in Australia and animal agriculture, which is deeply entwined in Australia. Australia, as people may know, is not a hugely populated country per capita, per number of people per, you know, meter or whatever the measure would be. But lots of Australia is dedicated to basically agriculture and grazing land for animals. The history of this, of course, is that the colonists arrived, they just basically decimated the forests and turned it into agricultural land. To me, actually, this is an example of a country where aspirations towards self-determination for Indigenous people and control over territory is interconnected with the end of animal agriculture. So to me, that's actually, again, in this context in Australia, there's every reason for animal advocates to be talking to or working with Indigenous people around the system of production that has come to dominate this territory and the injustices that system of production produces. Again, it doesn't mean that Indigenous groups have the same aspirations as animal advocates, but that to me is the nature of alliance politics. That's how it has to work.
Well, Dinesh Wadiwal, your two books, The War Against Animals and Animals of Capital, has given so much food for thought, if you pardon the pun. And I could certainly go on talking about it, but we'll bring at least this conversation to an end. I learned a great deal from reading, and I will no doubt be rereading your books and teaching them in my courses. Thank you so much for joining me on Countersign.
Thanks so much, Stuart. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.